Now is the time we're checking up on the week's news in national politics. Lawmakers are starting to consider ideas for a fourth major emergency relief package. States are taking steps to open their economies, even as cases of COVID-19 rise. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell raised the ire of some governors this week when he suggested states going bankrupt should be an option on the table rather than states receiving support from the federal government. You're part of this conversation. Our question for you this week is, what responsibility do you think the federal government has to states in a situation like this? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Should a future stimulus bill include money for state and local governments? Are you concerned about the cuts that would have to be made on the state level if the money just isn't there? Or do you think bankruptcy would be a tough but maybe necessary path? 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org. Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill, and he wrote the book Epidemic, Ebola, and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. Reed, good to have you back with us.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Certainly, as most states continue to keep large parts of their economies closed, it's putting a lot of strain on government finances. Just today, Wisconsin's Governor Tony Evers says he plans to cut state spending by 5% in the current fiscal year. What kinds of financial challenges are states around the country looking at?
Yeah, just listening to that news summary that played before we came on the air, it's just stunning to me. The national organizations that deal with state budgets, the state budget organization, the governor's associations, the conference of state legislatures, they're already saying that their local governments and state governments are going to face a deeper gap than we faced during the Great Recession about a decade ago. They're projecting losing up to 20% of their revenue over the coming years. I mean, we're talking multi-years here. California itself is projecting that in a modest recession, and this is going to be worse than that, that they would be facing $50 billion budget holes over a two-year period. That number is going to be revised way up. And just to sort of put a finer point on this, the state governments typically do not have the kind of flexibility that the federal government does. In bad economic times, the federal government can go into more debt. They can basically print more money sell bonds and treasury securities and things like that. States don't have that option. 49 out of the 50 states have a requirement that they have a balanced budget every year. And so that means that when we go into a recession and more people need state services and more people need sort of the social safety net, these states have to start cutting those very services and social safety net. So that's what we're already seeing, big cuts in education, big cuts in things like healthcare systems, and big cuts to even regular government agencies. I mean, the Attorney General of Michigan has already let go a quarter of her entire staff in anticipation of the budget crunch that's coming.
Sure. So then it might be saving state governments a little bit of money, but then you are exacerbating the fact that more people will apply for unemployment or more people will, you know, not have the means to participate and continue to buy things in the economy. I mean, these are all connected.
Yeah, they are. And that's why there are some suggestions that the notion of allowing a state to go into bankruptcy could turn a bad recession into a bad depression and could make all of this a lot worse. That's the case that a lot of the Democrats who support and even Republicans, this isn't necessarily a partisan thing. Even the Republicans who support bailing out the states and getting the federal government more involved are saying that, look, you've got to do this stuff now to prevent a disaster from becoming a catastrophe.
Yeah, I mean, you said the B word, bankruptcy. Last week, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell weighed in on the potential for more state and local government aid in a future stimulus bill, brought up the prospect of states declaring bankruptcy. Let's listen.
I would certainly be in favor of allowing states to use the bankruptcy route. It saves some cities, and there's no good reason for it not to be available. My guess is their first choice would be for the federal government to borrow money from future generations to send it down to them now so they don't have to do that. That's not something I'm going to be in favor of.
Not all governors responded positively to the majority leader's remarks. So what was their response?
Yeah, I don't think any governors responded positively to that. We have heard from Republican and Democratic governors who have basically said that this would be an avenue for absolute disaster in effectively requiring these states to cut their services to the absolute bone at the very time when more people need them. I mean, you mentioned people filing for unemployment benefits. The systems are so bad right now that there are some states that have California itself has shifted like 1,300 of its state employees over to a call center just to handle new unemployment benefits. The state of Oregon has a 100,000 person backlog in the number of people who have filed for unemployment benefits in just the last 5 weeks. These are insane numbers that we've never seen before. And so Democratic governors, Republican governors, universally condemned Mitch McConnell's statement. It's really hard to imagine how he's going to be able to keep that position when his own senators from states that are in trouble are up for reelection this year. And his own state, which has a Democratic governor, is going to face the same budget cuts as anywhere else. One thing that has been a real line of attack from blue state governors, particularly Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York, is that those wealthier blue states, New York, California, New Jersey, Connecticut, places like that, yeah, they tax their residents a lot more, but they also give a lot more money to the federal government than they get back in services. States like Kentucky have a smaller tax base that feeds the federal government less money, but they take back more in services like Medicare and Social Security and things like that. So there are sort of donor states and taker states, and Mitch McConnell represents a state that takes a lot more money from the federal government than it actually gives.
Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill, also an author, and we are talking about the current state of politics. It's our Week in Washington conversation, and we want to know from you, what responsibility does the federal government have to states right now during this COVID-19 pandemic? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let us know what you think about this and whether bankruptcy would be a difficult but important path, or if that's just not how you see the federal government and the states working together. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. McConnell did walk that back a little bit this week, I mean, to a degree, saying that state relief in some form is likely. What are the conditions he's thinking of attaching to that, though, Reed?
Well, we've seen a bunch of proposals that are sort of flying around right now. The process as they're moving towards the fourth version of the coronavirus relief is really up in the air right now. And one thing that I think is driving a lot of McConnell trying to get trying to make this a particular issue is that he's been left out of a lot of the negotiations around the first three rounds of stimulus or relief packages. A lot of them have been negotiated between House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. The last round was really a deal between Chuck Schumer, the Senate Democratic leader, the Senate Minority Leader, by the way, and Steven Mnuchin. McConnell has been a bit on the sidelines, and he's not accustomed to that in his tenure as the Majority Leader of the U.S. Senate. So this may be a way of forcing him back into the conversation. The Congress has already appropriated about $150 billion to the states. The amounts that they're throwing around now, that what the states might actually need, are truly mind-boggling numbers. The National Governors Association has asked for $500 billion. The National Conference of State Legislatures has asked for $300 billion. The National Association of Counties is asking for billions more for local governments. And then Governor Gavin Newsom of California said the other day in a letter to Nancy Pelosi that the states might need $1 trillion to recover, or at least just to mitigate the fact that the amount of money that they're going to lose based on this. He said that over the next 2 or 3 years, states stand to lose $1.5 trillion, and he's only asking for $1 trillion. I mean, only $1 trillion. What's the old line? $1 trillion here, $1 trillion there, and soon you're talking about real money.
Yeah, it's really hard to fathom that amount. It's also, I wonder what your take is when we're hearing all of these numbers, when you're reporting all of this information about what states need and the federal government saying, hey, not sure we can help you out. But then we also hear that the federal government is looking at bailouts for major corporations, those, you know, sort of too big to fail entities. How do we square that?
Yeah, that is where we get into a much more partisan discussion over the government's priorities and these small business loans that have instead gone to big corporations like Ruth's Chris Steakhouse and Shake Shack and things like that. How do we spend this money? What do we prioritize? And of course, that sort of gets to the fundamental disagreement that Democrats and Republicans have over the size of government and the role of government and who government should be looking out for.
All right. We are talking with Reed Wilson, who's a national correspondent at The Hill and also an author. And we will continue this conversation ahead. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the federal government be spending money to support state and local governments as they face big budget shortfalls? Or should states have to make cuts, maybe go bankrupt? There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. And our conversation continues here with you on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're talking with Reed Wilson, a national correspondent at The Hill, and we're looking at the response in Washington and around the country to the COVID-19 pandemic. And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Tom from Port Wing wants to do just that. Hi, Tom.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Here you admitted that the federal government can only print more money and the states can't. So that means the states should do what every individual does with their budget, which is live within their means. It's really that simple, because printing more money will simply cause every dollar that's out there to be devalued by that amount. And I think the feds are already drunk on money as it is.
All right. Thanks for that, Tom. And, you know, Tom's coming saying, how's the Fed going to print more money? We don't have this money to give to states. Is that something that you've been reporting on, Reed?
Well, I mean, sure. That's the conservative argument on this, what Mitch McConnell is saying. You heard him in the clip earlier. He said that this is a debt that will be passed on to future generations. I think what you'll hear the Democrats say is that, look, this is a time when more people than ever need the social safety net that these states create, whether it's unemployment benefits or health care or basically anything like that. This is what the sort of emergency button is for, and it's time for the federal government to press it. So yeah, that's the debate that is raging in Washington. I mean, the arguments here are no different than the arguments we've heard over Republican or Democratic spending priorities for the last, 50, 100 years. The fact is, it's just much more urgent now because there are so many people who are losing their jobs, who need these unemployment benefits, who need the social safety net that are now running dry.
Thanks again for that call, Tom, at 800-642-1234. We have Dan from DePere who also wants to join the conversation. Welcome, Dan.
Yeah, good afternoon. Some states, when the economy was good, and the economy until recently was very good, saved large rainy day emergency funds, including Wisconsin, by the way. And other states, you know, spend basically every dime that comes in, and they don't save for an emergency like this. And I'm a little suspicious that, you know, the states that were responsible that have savings accounts are going to bail out the states that spent every dollar. So I'd like your guest to comment on that.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Yeah. Reed, what's your take?
Well, Dan, let's talk about the state of California, which I've been reporting on for a long time. The last governor, Jerry Brown, we all thought of him as Governor Moonbeam, the super liberal. Well, as he was building that reputation, he was also saving more money than any state has ever saved in American history. The state's rainy day fund, I talked to their office just the other day, they've got something like $16 billion in reserves. That is unprecedented in American history. Now, if they were allowed, now the statute only allows them to spend half of that money in any given year in a disaster, but if they were allowed to spend all of that money in one year, it still would not cover just the very first year of debt that this crisis has brought on, the funding the gap that this crisis has left. So that gives you a sense of the scale here. Even the state that did the best in saving all their money is effectively going to be out of that rainy day fund before the fiscal year is even over. So that just gives you a sense of the scale of this absolute catastrophe that these states now face.
And then it sounds like the numbers may show that the savings may not go along with our conservative or liberal assumptions that liberal states have lots of debt and conservative states have lots of funds saved away. And suddenly, more conservative leaning states would be at risk of losing much more than states that just went crazy with spending.
Yeah, and one of the smart things that a lot of states realized after the Depression, and this is not a partisan thing, this happened in blue states and red states, is that they when they were funding new items, when the budget was good, when things were looking good, they were funding them on a one-time basis. So you spend, if you've got an extra $1 billion here, you spend that on something that is going to be completed this year rather than a program that's going to extend way off into the future, because that program will then have to be cut when the bad budget times come. So, people's understanding of state budgets has really evolved since the recession. They were initially planned. I mean, there was going to be another recession no matter what. That's just how the economy works. The fact is, this one is just so much deeper than anything that anybody anticipated that there was basically no planning they could do.
Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill, and we are talking about what's going on this week in Washington. And we do have an eye on that phase four bill, Reed. Do we have a sense of the big areas of focus that would be included in a fourth, economic bill?
Well, the county and state and local governments has been the forefront of that. Mm-hmm. The Paycheck Protection Program that we've heard about now a couple of times, that has gone through a couple of rounds of funding, was out of funding almost immediately when they opened again. So you can imagine that that'll probably be another element of spending here. I'm old enough to remember Bill Clinton declaring the era of big government was over. Well, the era of big government is back, and it's spending quite a bit of money now, probably more money in the last 2 months than Republicans would pretty much ever be comfortable with in normal times. But then again, these are not normal times.
No, they are not. You've also been following the latest numbers and public health response. I mean, this week, the U.S. saw its 1 millionth confirmed case of COVID-19. How are you seeing these newer cases distributed around the country?
Well, they're moving now. There have been sort of phases to this outbreak. And the first phases started in cities like New York and Seattle, my hometown of Seattle, where the disease was imported from overseas. The Seattle version probably came from Wuhan. The New York version was probably seeded by travelers coming back from Italy, which got hit hard, of course, too. So those were the initial hotspots. Lately, though, we've seen more and more smaller and rural counties getting hit by this virus. And that's troubling for a couple of reasons. First of all, these are counties that have less money and less health capacity than larger counties. You can imagine that, a rural county of 10,000 residents simply doesn't have the health capacity that, say, New York City or Boston does. On the other hand, their populations are older. They are more likely to have pre-existing conditions like hypertension or diabetes or heart disease. So basically, they're more at risk in a place where there's less capacity to care for them. Now, the good news is, in a lot of these rural counties, is that social distancing is something that they practice sort of by nature. There is no subway to ride on. People live a block apart from each other or something like that. There's not sort of the same density issues that makes an outbreak in New York or Milwaukee or places like that more dangerous. We've also seen a significant number of cases in southern cities, in other cities aside from New York and Seattle. New Orleans is now recovering from what was a truly disastrous outbreak. Detroit has really struggled with a number of cases there. Boston is quietly becoming one of the epicenters of this outbreak, one of the hardest hit cities. So we've seen the virus disperse. That's pretty normal. That's the way viruses happen. You tend to get, in the course of, say, a normal flu season, you tend to get the first cases in a big city with an international hub airport, and then the virus then diffuses to other smaller places across the country. That's what we're seeing now, which means that these rural areas have had time to prepare, and a lot of them have done a really good job in preparing, getting the equipment necessary. But the thing that has really struck me about this particular virus and why it's so different is the number of ways in which it is manifesting in patients. This is not just a virus that carries with it fever, cough, and shortness of breath. This is a virus that now includes chills, and the symptoms that the CDC are warning about are a loss of a sense of taste and smell. We've heard about a number of people who manifest with pink eye and toe lesions and things like that. So basically, this is a virus that we just don't understand yet. We don't understand how it is attacking so many systems within our bodies and how it can put some people on a ventilator right away, and other people get it and have absolutely no symptoms, or at least the mildest of colds. So there's not a ton of rhyme or reason, which makes treating this, finding an appropriate treatment, all the more difficult.
And also probably then makes trying to craft public policy to handle it more difficult too.
Well, it's funny. The playbook that we're using to fight this virus is the same playbook we've been using for about 100 years. I mean, we started the concept of social distancing back in 1918 during the Spanish flu. We even started things like wearing masks in public back then, 100 years ago, after a plague outbreak in Manchuria, bizarrely enough. But there's an interesting difference here between first world countries and developing world countries. In first world countries, we put a lot of our emphasis on technology and medicine. That's the way that we know how to treat diseases. We basically throw money at the problem and come up with a drug that can treat it or a vaccine, and
right.
That's what we do.
Yep. And it's different around the world with those other barrier methods. Hey, Reed, I'm sorry we have to wrap it up here, but thank you so much for talking with us today.
You got it.
Reed Wilson is a national correspondent at The Hill and the author of the book Epidemic Ebola and the Global Scramble to Prevent the Next Killer Outbreak. This is Central Time.